would never know until we do it. I mean, it's only four votes.
Candidates in House District 40 prepare for a recount Monday. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 9th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, a carpenter in Juneau builds a tiny home with reclaimed materials.
This business, I feel good when I come here because it's not taking things apart and putting it in the dump. I feel good because it's reusing what we can.
But will city officials let him park it anywhere? Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
There will be a recount on Monday of the Democratic primary results for the House District covering the North Slope and Northwest Arctic boroughs. Representative Benjamin Nagyak requested the recount. Nagyak trails Dean Westlake by four votes in the certified count. Division of Elections Director Josie Banky says the recount will take place in Juneau.
We've got staff and state review board members that will be counting the ballot using four optical scan units. And so both candidates have been informed and are allowed to have one observer at each unit.
Nagyak says he's hopeful about the recount.
If it came to be that it was positive for my campaign, I think it would be great. But, you know, we'll never know until we do it. I mean, it's only four votes.
Nagyak caucuses with the Republican House majority. Republican officials have raised concerns about the handling of ballots in the Kobuk River community of Shugnak. Nagyak has hired an election attorney, Timothy McKeever, to advise him, and he says all options are on the table for pursuing legal challenges to the results. Westlake couldn't be reached for comment, and Banky didn't provide a time frame for when the recount would be completed. Governor Bill Walker has vetoed a bill today that would have set aside University of Alaska board seats for residents from different geographic areas. The governor will continue to be able to appoint the 11 boards of regent members without geographic limits on where they live. Supporters of House Bill 107 said the bill would increase the representation of Matanuska, Susitna, and Kenai boroughs, as well as residents who live off the road system. Walker said in a letter to House Speaker Mike Chennault that there's no evidence that some areas are unheard and that it's important for board members to respect each area. Bill sponsor Wasilla Republican Lynn Gaddis says she doesn't agree with Walker's reasoning.
Boy, that's a lot of BS. And you could go ahead and put that on the radio. Because I think the bottom line is the fact that we do have very different regions. That's why we elect representatives from those different regions. They bring a different flavor to the table.
It's Walker's fifth veto as governor, other than budget line item vetoes. A New York Times article today points out that murder rates in a quarter of the country's largest cities are up. Among them is Anchorage. The story only draws on data through 2015 and so doesn't include the 25 homicides Alaska's largest city has seen this year. Though city officials have been all over town trying to explain what's happening and what they're doing about it, many people simply do not feel safe, not even at home. Under a wooden pavilion in Valley of the Moon Park Thursday evening, a crowd of residents, maybe 150, forms a huge circle around Anchorage's mayor and police chief, asking questions and sharing concerns. At times, things feel like they're about to devolve into chaos.
There's a level of activity going on in all of these camps.
What about the people? It's not just the
camps.
The worries and suggestions run the gamut, from highly technical recommendations for submitting police reports to broad calls for armed citizen patrols. One man even suggests that the city should look to the Philippines for guidance, where extrajudicial killings are spiking, a view not warmly embraced by the surrounding crowd.
Yeah, well, I'm a right winger, but the point is,
But there was plenty of civility, too, with laughs and applause as Mayor Ethan Berkowitz and Police Chief Chris Talley fielded questions and explained how the city is addressing the issue. It lasted an hour and a half. And this is the same park where, less than 2 weeks ago, Bree DeHuizen and Kevin Turner were murdered, which many people in this affluent area near downtown say was a breaking point for them. Eva Gardner lives nearby and helped coordinate a letter signed by more than 90 people, which was sent to the mayor, asking for solutions to a perceived rise in crime and violence.
My point was to point out some discrepancies in what I was hearing, which was the mayor was, on the one hand, and the police chief reassuring us that we're actually relatively safe, but that kind of jars when you look back last week at the warning that APD put out about staying off the trails after dark.
Gardner was referring to a statement issued by the police department just after the Valley of the Moon killings, advising residents not to travel alone at night through parks, trails, or on quiet streets. But many residents say quick access to parks and trails is exactly why they live there. Larry Gordioff's lived in Anchorage since the 70s and raised his family in this neighborhood. He says there's always been crime in Anchorage. The new part is that it's come to Valley of the Moon.
Years ago, we cleaned up Spinard. Big deal in the city, we're cleaning Spinard up. Well, they moved to Mountain View. So then they get over, we're going to clean up Mountain View. They moved to Fairview. Then they moved down to the town square. And when they kicked them out of there, here they are. So where do they go next?
This is a vision of public safety as an unresolved game of whack-a-mole. And city and police officials have been at pains in the last few weeks to plead their case to the public that they're not just pushing problems to other parts of town. They've stressed long-term solutions that City Hall is pushing, like more housing for vulnerable residents, a homeless coordinator, and an aggressive effort to rebuild the police department's staffing levels. But for Rosalind Thompson, that is just not a comfort.
I'm friends with Bree. Came back up here to be with friends and family after I heard what happened. And mostly my original concern was over the lights. I mean, because I lived in Valley of the Moon for 3 years before I moved out of state this summer. And oftentimes, like, the lights won't be on when I'm out walking. And it's just like, I wondered. I was like, okay, well, were the street lights on the night that Bree was murdered?
Several residents asked about the possibility of a serial killer. Chief Chris Talley has been adamant that he won't speculate on that question or any of the unresolved cases. For many people, that's an inadequate response. But Thompson was less troubled by that than by how much of the conversation hovered around blaming homeless people.
I mean, it was a friend of mine that was murdered, and for no reason, as far as I know. It is concerning, and I feel like my hypervigilance is, like, through the roof, especially since, like, the mayor and police chief are just giving us, you know, fluffy political answers. So, I mean, I think people have a right to be concerned, but I wish they weren't demonizing the homeless while they're at it.
After the forum wrapped up, the mayor and police chief stuck around to talk with lingering residents one-on-one, even as their staffs tried pushing them to their next engagements. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, shedding light on a little-known group of Buffalo soldiers.
They were not only serving their country, but they were also fighting on a second front, a war of discrimination and bigotry.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
There might be a small solution to the capital city's housing problem, but it's not without roadblocks. A Juneau company is building its first tiny house on wheels to sell commercially, and it intends to make more. The diminutive dwelling is crafted with reclaimed materials and locally sourced wood. But the city's zoning codes haven't caught up with the tiny house craze. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
For 160 square feet, this rolling home feels pretty spacious. Step inside and you're greeted with high ceilings and large windows. At this point, it's still a shell, which can make identifying the bathroom tricky.
So right now, I'm in the bathroom.
Nope, you're still in the kitchen.
Still in the kitchen.
Jason Donick and a friend are the builders of this small home. which is being constructed at AK Reuse, Donick's business. It's in an industrial part of town, and for a guy really passionate about recycled materials, it's the perfect spot to draw inspiration. There are crates of mismatched drawer pulls, old doors, a vintage gym floor.
We got a bidet. I don't know how cool that is, but
the bidet isn't going in the tiny house. But Donick says other pieces from the yard are. People drop items off at AK Reuse, and he sells them to customers looking for unique or inexpensive home materials. As a carpenter, Donick says he was frustrated by what others would throw away.
This business, I feel good when I come here because it's not taking things apart and putting it in the dump. I feel good because it's reusing what we can, and same with the tiny home.
Donick says he decided to build small because he saw his friend struggling to save up for a mortgage. This tiny home is on the high end. It could cost more than $70,000, but he thinks it could be done for less.
Across the nation, people are going small.
And if you've watched TV lately, you're probably familiar with the idea of families willingly downsizing to 200 square feet.
It looks really small.
Donick says he hasn't seen any of these.
Me either, because I'm afraid.
What are you afraid of?
Oh, I don't know. Just because I know it's an issue coming up.
That's Beth McKibben, a planning manager at the City and Borough of Juneau. Some communities in Alaska are skeptical that this is the solution cities should be looking for when it comes to a tight housing market. Wasilla's city council recently banned tiny houses for a temporary period due to concerns about landlords building multiple units on a single lot and what it could do to a neighborhood's character. In Juneau, the real issue is, what do you do with the house that rolls? You can build a 120-square-foot home on a permanent structure, but can you park one if it's on wheels in your friend's backyard?
Depends on where the house might be. So it's a big fat maybe.
Maybe, because it's not zoned for every location. Tiny houses on wheels can go in mobile home parks, no problem. But it requires a trip to the Planning Commission before rolling one onto someone's private lot. So far, McKibben says no one has appeared before them to get the ultimate okay. But she thinks it's only a matter of time before more small homes start popping up.
Well, for me, that's a concern right now. If people are going to buy them, they need to know that they can place them somewhere. They shouldn't be making an investment in something not knowing what they can do with that.
In Sitka, at least one tiny house on wheels is headed before the Planning Commission. It would be parked in a residential neighborhood, but nothing's been decided yet. McKibben expects a zoning conversation to happen in Juneau later this year. Back at the building site, Donick is working on what will become the sleeping loft in the tiny house. He's talked to people who work at the city about what's coming down the line, and he thinks they'll be able to work something out that could keep more tiny houses in production. Still, if he could change one thing, besides the zoning rules, it would be the namesake of the movement.
The word tiny home makes me think of something really tiny. I don't want to live in something that's called a tiny home. I'd want to live in something that's called a modest home.
He expects this modest home to be completed by spring, and he wants to build more after that. Just don't call him that tiny house guy. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
In the most recent issue of The New Yorker magazine, Alaska writer and longtime former ADN reporter Tom Kazaya looks back at the debate over offshore drilling in North Slope communities and at how climate change is affecting the region's twin pillars, development, oil development, and subsistence hunting. Kazaya spoke about his reporting with Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk. He says it's easy to label communities as being either for or against oil development, but in his reporting, he found a lot of residents could see both sides.
I think a lot of people really kind of held both opinions at the same time was one of my sense, that where they individually, they would sort of lean one way or lean the other. But the sort of flag waving leaders on either side weren't as common as the people who sort of had this deep ambivalence and anguish about what they might be doing to their wailing future. But at the same time, if they didn't have the income, the property tax income to keep the civilization running up there, how were they going to continue to live? So that was what was impressive to me, was that sort of ambivalence in the middle that so many people had.
And what drew you to this particular story?
Well, you know, I think underlying that debate over offshore oil is the question of how the climate is changing, the ice is melting, and what's going to happen to the ancient culture up there if the ice goes away. You know, they're looking at, you know, a future of a warmer future that's going to really change the way things are done up there, that have been done up there, and they're trying to figure out how to respond to that. And in that sense, they're, you know, just like all Americans, but it's so much more concentrated. You can sort of see the dilemma within the Inupiaq culture in some ways more easily as an outsider than you can when you look at, you know, our North American culture. But it's really the same dilemma, you know.
You open the story with this amazing scene out on the sea ice, and I'm wondering if you could just sort of describe that a little bit for our listeners.
It was a year ago in the spring, the ice had gotten so thin that they couldn't hunt bowheads anymore off Point Hope. Basically, the hunters were just out there on their own watching the whales swim by. I saw some amazing photos. You know, you could see the black backs of the whales right there in the leads, and they couldn't catch them. And while they're out there, suddenly there are three warning shots, and the warning shots meant the ice lead had broken off behind them, and they were on a piece of ice that was threatening to float away and carry them off to sea. They got back, and they could see there was like 100 yards of blue water between them and the shore fast ice, and their solution was to take their snow machines and get a good running start and then hit the water and just skip like stones across the open ocean to get back up onto the ice on the shore side. It was just pretty terrifying moment for a lot of people. And it's something that kids that do, I'm told, in the lagoons up there in the summer, practice with their snow machines. And it turned out to be a pretty useful technique for saving their lives.
And you have this sort of amazing line towards the end of the story where you say that people have worried that they need to choose between oil and subsistence and now are facing the prospect of potentially losing both. I mean, is it really that bleak? Is there really that fear up there?
Well, I hope not. I mean, clearly nobody wants that to happen. But I just wanted to describe in broad strokes how that situation is beginning to come into focus as a possibility. And, you know, there's not a real easy checklist of things that we can do to deal with that. But I think, you know, as a journalist, trying to recognize what the challenges are before us is sometimes the first step. And in Alaska, that's often, you know, clouded by our sort of short-term interests. Hard to see the big picture.
That was writer Tom Keziah speaking with reporter Rachel Waldholtz. Keziah's story on oil and subsistence in a warming Arctic is in the most recent issue of The New Yorker magazine. And thanks to KBBI and Homer for their help recording that interview.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Buffalo Soldiers. And when you think of Buffalo Soldiers, does Alaska come to mind? Probably not. But the African-American units formed in the late 19th century before the military was desegregated are a part of Alaska's history, specifically Skagway's history during the days of the Klondike Gold Rush. It's a seldom told story that's now in the spotlight. That's because Alaska's most visited national park is part of a nationwide effort to make the parks relevant to an increasingly diverse America. KHNS's Emily Files has more.
And Skagway in 1898 was a pretty rough place.
Park ranger Charlotte Henson is holding up black and white photos of Gold Rush era Skagway for a couple dozen tourists to see. She tells the story of Alaska Territorial Governor John Brady writing a plea to the Capitol.
He wrote to Washington, and he said to Washington, "The Lynn Canal is full of gamblers, thugs, and loose women," unquote. Send help.
And help was sent.
Company L of the 24th United States Infantry that was stationed here for 3 years, from 1899 to 1901.
Ben Hayes is chief of interpretation for Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park. Company L was an all-black regiment sent from San Francisco to the booming mining settlement of Dyea. A few weeks later, they moved to the nearby town of Skagway.
And so they lived their lives here, and in many cases we found they were not only serving their country, but they were also fighting on a second front, and that was a war of discrimination and bigotry.
Back on the walking tour, Henson leads the group to a busy street across from the historical YMCA to tell one of those stories of discrimination. She reads from a newspaper clipping from 1900.
The line drawn, objections arise to colored men in YMCA. Withdrawals made.
Racial discrimination is a constant thread throughout American history. But until this summer, that piece of Skagway's history was mostly unexamined and untold. Why is the story being brought to the forefront now? The National Park Service is concerned about the disparity between the people who visit parks and the American population as a whole. Park visitors are overwhelmingly older and white.
It is very concerning that we have audiences that don't reflect the true makeup of America.
The Park Service has decided that to remain relevant, they have to find a way to appeal to a more diverse audience. That's what prompted the Klondike Park to apply for a federal grant aimed at preservation of the civil rights movement. The park was the only one in Alaska to receive such a grant this year. The $22,000 appropriation motivated Hayes to do something unusual. Normally, the rangers who give tours get to choose what they focus on, but this year, he required all of them to research and give talks about Company L, Skagway's Buffalo Soldiers.
I hated the idea. I didn't feel like I had enough information.
Charlotte Henson again.
And so I was kicking and screaming. I might have been one of the last ones to get my walk done.
But now Henson says she's realized how important it is to tell this story, one that's been relegated to the background for so long.
They help make our society the way it is today, and we need to be aware that it's just not white people that have done everything in this country.
Unlike the Soapy Smiths of Skagway, there's not a lot of information available about the men of Company L. Henson describes it as a puzzle the rangers are slowly piecing together.
We don't know what they thought about Skagway. We really don't know what Skagway thought about them other than our newspaper.
Michigan resident Sharon Williams is one of about 30 people who followed along on Henson's tour.
I knew about the Buffalo Soldiers. I didn't know that they had come as far north as Alaska.
Williams is on a high school reunion cruise. She says her Virginia school was segregated until her senior year. Williams says she did not expect to hear tales of civil rights on her cruise to the 49th state.
I thought it was very well done, and I just appreciate, she said, the fact that they had to start trying to put the pieces of this puzzle together, and I'm sure there's a lot more that's going to be uncovered as they, you know, get pictures and newspaper clippings and that type of thing, but it's a start.
The rangers have been working this summer to track down a living descendant of Company L, in hopes that family stories will shed light on these men. Additionally, the Klondike Park hopes to keep Skagway's Buffalo Soldiers in the spotlight beyond this summer. Hayes plans to apply for the same grant funding next year to continue telling visitors about this little-known piece of history. Reporting in Skagway, I'm Emily Files.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Karen Brown, who moved to Anchorage 15 years ago to teach at Mountain View Elementary.
it's like the biggest place I've ever lived in the city, you know, because I came from a small town of like 9,000 people. So this was, it was a very getting used to. It was scary because we had to drive here, and when you're driving across the, you know, territories to get here, and there's nothing out there, and there were several times we're like, well, maybe we'll just turn around and go home. But we kept coming and we kept coming, and then we finally got here. Because I was a school teacher, and like I said, my brother-in-law, who also came along with me when I moved up here, said, let's just go to the neighborhood where your school is, because Mountain View is like a very diverse community. I learned a lot about other cultures. I mean, we participated in Chinese New Year celebration and the Samoan culture. For my niece that was with me, she was 5 at the time and went to Mountain View through the 6th grade, that she learned and was more accepting to different cultures and different, you know, just people and the ways of life. Today with her, you know, she's more accepting of people and things, you know, because I believe because of the way she was brought up here, you know, having friends of every kind of race you can imagine.
Karen Brown lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Files and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We have reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Annie Fite produced tonight's show, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs and dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people. The 2016 Alaska State Fair will be completely smoke-free, protecting all fairgoers from exposure to tobacco smoke and the aerosol from electronic smoking devices. If you use tobacco or e-cigarettes, now is a great time to connect with Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line for free support, to set a quit date, and then breathe easy at the Alaska State Fair. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.